This is Audible.
Audible Studios presents A Stash of One's Own, Knitters on Loving, Living With, and Letting Go of Yarn. Written by Clara Parks, performed by Kate Udall, Kevin T. Collins, and Eliza Foss.
Inheriting from Elizabeth Zimmerman by Meg Swanson. I'm the youngest of Arnold and Elizabeth Zimmerman's three children. One evening, when I was about seven, my mother divided a large sheet of paper into three vertical columns. She wrote one of our names at the top of each column. The paper was then passed around to each of us in turn, and we were to write down, one item at a time, whatever family artifacts we wished to inherit. Being so young, it didn't occur to me to put down the things of great value that belonged to my family, as my brother and sister were doing. My very first choice was the dictionary. It was a grand dictionary, too large for me to lift, and it lived on its own lectern in the living room. The words, "look it up," were frequently spoken at our house. My choice was not based on a forward flash of intuition that my future as a teacher, writer, and publisher would be so entwined with words. Rather, with both my parents being multilingual, words were important, and the dictionary was revered. Like most families, we had our own invented words, and even an entire cat language we spoke to our cats, this having been acquired by my mother from her father. Besides the dictionary, I inherited a tome of knowledge directly from my mother. We wrote each other silly letters in our made-up language and characters. Through her, I have memorized countless poems, both proper and inane. We also shared a passion for knitting, which gradually evolved from Elizabeth Zimmerman Limited into Schoolhouse Press, a business that the two of us operated together with my husband, Chris, and which today is run by our son, Cully, and his wife, Michelle. My mother taught me how to knit when I was about four. We lived in New Hope, Pennsylvania. My memory of it is quite vivid. We were on the back porch overlooking the Delaware River, and I sat on her lap. She had her arms around me, guiding my hands through the moves. I was pleased and proud. And I knitted sporadically over the next decade. Being first-generation Americans, we had no relatives in the United States, so we sent and received Christmas presents to and from various family members in Germany and the United Kingdom. The first actual project I can remember was a scarf I knitted for my Auntie Pete when I was about six or seven, back and forth in garter stitch, but with a series of short rows around the back of the neck to form a horseshoe curve. I had no idea what I was doing. I just followed my mother's verbal instructions. Barbara G. Walker had not yet invented short rows and wrapping. During the decades with my mom, I inherited tips, tricks, ideas, and innovations through our knitting failures and triumphs. As I got older, we occasionally disagreed on a technique, like her idea to knit both strands together when joining in a new skein. Leave two tails and darn them in later. Actually, that may have been when I taught myself to spit splice. I also absorbed Elizabeth's philosophical attitude toward knitting and life, which resonates through all her books. You are the boss of your knitting and can do what you like. There is no wrong in knitting, as long as you are pleased with the results. In her first book, Knitting Without Tears, she wrote, "Now comes what I perhaps inflatedly call my philosophy of knitting. Like many philosophies, it is hard to express in a few words. Its main tenets are enjoyment and satisfaction, accompanied by thrift, inventiveness, an appearance of industry, and above all, resourcefulness. When you are obsessed by wool and knitting, for as long as my mother was, you are bound to accumulate an impressive stash. Not only masses of wool and needles, but books, tools, and other accoutrements of knitting. Included in her cache were swatches, fragments of knitting, abandoned projects, a sweater body with no sleeves, a single sleeve with no body, and even some unidentifiable artifacts still on their needles, for which there was no explanation. All these items were stashed throughout a vast collection of knitting bags, baskets, drawers, shelves, boxes, and bins. Of equal, or perhaps more, importance are Elizabeth's journals, which contain notes, directions, charts, and sketches. Some are complete, but many are just a shell of an idea, like a few bones of a skeleton. Can a knitting archaeologist build an entire garment from these sketchy clues? Some of the journals are overflowing with extra pages paper-clipped or held in by rubber bands. We also found stacks of loose papers, typed or handwritten pages, charts on graph paper, drawings, or hieroglyphic directions on the backs of envelopes or on hotel notepads. A knitting journal can be a fascinating chronicle of a knitter's life, where ideas, observations, failed attempts, and successful garments are all recorded unexpurgated. It becomes a stash of knowledge and a reflection of the author's creative mind. One of my favorite finds is Fun Feet, her design for garter stitch slippers. The idea was sketched and notated on a small memo pad from my father's office. As I knitted what may have been the very first pair of these slippers, I never saw this concept realized by Elizabeth. I didn't understand all the short rows across the middle of the foot until I was finished. Yes, to keep the sides from flopping out. It is a brilliant bit of knitted sculpture. Elizabeth's archive is extensive. We are still unearthing things that, upon reading and or comprehending what she was driving at, bring her back into the present day. Along with everything mentioned above, there are stacks of scrapbooks, plus correspondence with Barbara G. Walker, Kay Fassett, Gladys Thompson, and other designers and authors, many of whom Elizabeth both inspired and supported as they made their own way in this business. We have come upon a slew of drafts and published manuscripts, letters to and from publishers, notebooks of ideas, plus several accountants' ledgers filled with the minutiae of Elizabeth's early mail-order business records. I may even still have the thousands of file cards we kept, one for each of our customers, with every order recorded on the card as it was shipped. Several scholars have spent time with this material over the past 10 years. In 2006, Molly Greenfield, a graduate student in textiles at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, curated an exhibit of some of the archive as part of her thesis work. The exhibit, titled New School Knitting, The Influence of Elizabeth Zimmerman and Schoolhouse Press, was well executed, and I spoke at the Fill to Capacity opening event. In 2009, Catherine Parks, an undergraduate student in history at the University of Wisconsin, Eau Claire, and her professor, Colleen McFarland, visited Schoolhouse Press and spent time examining sweaters and documents as they researched for their in-depth article in Wisconsin Magazine of History, Winter 2011-12, with a photo of Elizabeth on the cover, stitch by stitch, the life and legacy of Elizabeth Zimmerman. The Wisconsin Historical Society was stunned by the onslaught of knitters ordering copies, and they quickly had to reprint that issue. Most recently, Lily Marsh spent several weeks over two summers with Elizabeth's works as she completed her dissertation at Purdue University. Other scholars have expressed interest in bringing the archive material to light. Though we do not know its eventual destiny, we are exploring ideas to make at least some of the archive accessible to knitters. Elizabeth Zimmerman's remarkably unique approach to knitting was not inherited by me alone. It was delivered to innumerable knitters over many decades, both in person and in written form, through her frequent workshops, many knitting books, TV programs, and videos, as well as her semi-annual publications, newsletter, and wool gathering. Elizabeth's family and heirs include all who read and are swayed by her words to this very day. When I was a kid, my mother's dear friend and knitting buddy was our neighbor, Ruth. Our fenced backyards were adjacent. Since the two of them visited each other so frequently, my father and Ruth's husband, Frederick, teamed up to build a stile over the fence, which enabled Ruth and Elizabeth to zip back and forth with ease. Decades later, when Ruth died, Elizabeth lamented deeply. My mom later told me how she had wished for something of Ruth's to hold. A knitting needle, book, pen, thimble, something relatively mundane that Ruth had cherished. With Ruth's family in mourning, it was impossible to hint, much less ask outright, for some small memento, and sadly, none was ever forthcoming. I remember that conversation clearly when my mother died, and the following summer I sorted through scores of her small knitted garments, some items still on the needles, bits of ribbing, the start of a sock, a single mitten or glove, a test Mobius twist, a bit of I-cord, and numerous Aaron's watches. From this assortment, I put one article into each of 65 new bags and tied them with wool. Then all the bags went into a large burlap wool sack, which I took to our off-timers knitting camp. I told the campers my mother's story about Ruth, and that I imagined many of them felt the same way about Elizabeth. Most of them had been coming annually since the early years, beginning in 1974, and were doted upon by my mother. Over the next few days, during show and tell, each knitter was asked to reach into the sack, with eyes closed, for a tangible remembrance of their friend and teacher. The campers were touched and delighted, many going so far as to frame their inheritance. The most treasured feature of my mother's stash is her collection of finished garments. Prototypes of her designs for sweaters, shawls, coats, jackets, baby things, endless caps, socks, mittens, and blankets. Many of the articles are missing from the collection, as Elizabeth was generous about sending her knitted pieces to friends and to family overseas. The things that remained in her stash are now merged with my own, and together they live in a cedar-lined room. For many decades before, all sweaters lived in large wooden boxes made by my husband, Chris. They were airtight and lined with eastern red cedar. In 2006, when my son, Cully, designed a new office, warehouse building down the hill from my schoolhouse, I requested a sweater room. It is in the middle of the building, and the walls are covered with eastern red cedar shelves. This is a wonderful solution to the issue of stash storage and preservation. All of our finished garments are within easy reach, and we often turn to them for inspiration or for solutions to technical difficulties. Like my mother, I keep my current stash at home all around me, and once a design is finished and published, it goes into the sweater room. Elizabeth's philosophy of openness and dissemination of information is one I continue, and because of this, some of her garments travel to and from our annual knitting camps for participants to examine and scrutinize for their own innovation and ingenuity. They are especially treasured because her knitted garments represent love. Indeed, although Elizabeth's works were designed and knitted as tangible representations of the explorations of a brilliantly creative mind, they still serve as comforting, warm, functional garments for those she loved. I can trace the growth of our children by the successively larger sweaters their grandmother knitted for them. Those same sweaters have been worn again by the great-grandchildren she never met. Elizabeth Zimmerman's stash lives on, both the physical garments that I inherited, and more importantly and enduringly, her transformative ideas, which she has bequeathed to all knitters. Stashers. Who the heck are we? A peek at the numbers, looking for answers. By Leila Nargi. Wherever there are knitters, there are, inevitably, stashers. Those of us who accumulate great numbers of balls of fiber for reasons ranging from incidental, oops, I bought more pashmina than I needed for that cardigan, to slightly deranged. That skein of knit collage gypsy garden was literally calling my name as I walked into the shop, so I had to buy it. In triplicate. In all 10 colorways. One species of stasher will inevitably look askance at the others, certain their reasons fall more into the category of reasons than others. Insert eye roll and scornful pff here. But is there more that binds us than separates us? Can math provide a counterpoint to answers that rely solely on illogical emotion? With the help of the online fiber craft community, Ravelry, I wrestled up some numbers to see if they would lend any clarity to the matter. However, before we take a soul-searching sift through the stats about stashes and us stashers, let's first give some consideration to the word itself. Stash, the noun, entered our American English vernacular in 1914 with decidedly criminal overtones. Someone who stashed a stash was likely a thief, squirreling away stolen goods. You could also stash your stash in a stash. That is, hole the loot up in your hideout. although it took only a few decades for Stash to be sanitized of intimations of illegal activity. Contemporary yarn stashers, when discussing their, we'll call them, collections, can often feel as though they are confessing some wrongdoing without any clear understanding of the nature of their crime. What is it we fear we might be guilty of? Let's have a look. It's hard to know for sure what percentage of all knitters are also stashers. We do know that a mere 5% of Ravelry's 6.6 million users, some 307,000 knitters, weavers, and crocheters total, are stashers. Or rather, use Ravelry to publicly track or admit to their stash. The numbers seem to further indicate that the greatest American stashers, by a long shot, are Californian, almost double the next demographics of New Yorkers or Texans. The largest group of non-English-speaking stashers are German, followed by French, then a succession of Scandinavians. As temperatures and humidity rise, the number of stashers drops precipitously, but they're still in evidence. There are two stashers each in Guam, American Samoa, and the Federated States of Micronesia. There's one each in an impressively diverse assemblage of international locales, including Niger, Côte d'Ivoire, the Maldives, St. Kitts and Nevis, Liechtenstein, Vatican City, Kosovo, Bouvet Island, East Timor, Botswana, French Southern and Antarctic lands, Vanuatu, Tonga, Kyrgyzstan, Aruba, St. Lucia, Northern Mariana Islands, Heard and McDonald Islands, Sri Lanka, Togo, Tuvalu, New Caledonia, the Falkland Islands, the Seychelles, South Georgia and the South Sandwich Islands, Tunisia, Niue, the Marshall Islands, Cuba, Madagascar, the British Virgin Islands, Haiti, and Albania. All by way of saying, pretty much anywhere in the world, if you run out of yarn and there is no local yarn store, LYS, available to you, chances are high that you'll find at least one human who can hook you up with the yarn fix. Together, this very particular accumulation of Ravelry folk has more than 20,647,000 skeins of yarn logged into their virtual stashes. That averages out to more than 68 skeins per person. So far, none of this sounds like the activity of nefarious masterminds, though. Not if we assume that each one of these 20 million plus skeins was come by legally. Disappointingly, Ravelry doesn't track stolen skeins, either by purchase, gift or trade, or homespinning. And not if we consider, too, that the aim of a stasher using the goods in his or her own stash is to create hats or mittens or blankets or socks, possibly with the further goal of giving them away as gifts. Yes. Ravelry stashers are sometimes looking to divest themselves of bits and pieces of their collections. Some 53,000 of them are actively engaged in that pursuit as you listen to this. But on average, according to my in-house sources at Ravelry, they are probably more interested in using the site's stash function in order to figure out which skeins to yank out in preparation for the next work in progress, WIP. Why go through your whole collection manually when you can see it all tidy online alongside already completed projects in various colorways stitched up by your knitting compatriots? All those stash skeins weigh in at an incredible 8.4 million pounds, more than the combined heft of a small bridge, a drilling rig, a giant sequoia, and one blue whale. Unwind them, and you've got almost 5 billion yards of yarn. Yeah, you heard that right. 5 billion yards, which is 2.8 million miles. Ignoring weight and gauge, that's enough to knit 22 million socks, or about 4.5 million medium-sized women's sweaters. Most of those socks, or sweaters, are probably going to be knit from yarn containing merino or generic wool. More than 6.3 million stashed skeins in the color blue, 537,000, skeins, or green, 443,000. Sock knitters will feel comfortable with the fact that the most popular stashed yarn weight is fingering, or light fingering, 3.2 million skeins. Sweater fanciers will revel in this statistic. The combined total number of sport, DK, worsted, and Aran is a robust 5,070,148 skeins. We appear to be less enthused about threadweight hemp in yellow-green colorways. Only one such skein is currently stashed, although we deem that slightly more desirable than the possibility of cobweb weight kiviet, or yak, in shades of yellow-orange, currently not featured in any stash whatsoever. Of the 10.2 million stash entries marked as in stash on Ravelry, there are an almost equal number that consist of one skein, 3.9 million, and multiple skeins, 3.8 million. Slightly more than 830,000 entries consist of less than an entire skein. What's the largest number of skeins anyone has tucked into their Ravelry stash? You will either be glad or very sorry, you asked. Regardless, the owner is doubtless someone you'd like to cozy up to. She, or he, is the proud stasher of 11,839 skeins of yarn. The next stasher in line has a still impressive 11,522 skeins in his or her collection. If these figures seem boggling or even worrisome, please consider the German word for stash, Vorrat. Its translation is devoid of illicit overtones, rather connoting a stock or reserve of materials that a mindful person will need for some future purpose. As an added bonus, the term also happens to contain the word Rat, which Austrian knitting designer Veronika Perche tells me literally means advice. So, she says, it is a wise thing to build a Vorrat in order to be prepared in times of need. Now that's a definition to stash away and pull out if ever, whenever, our beloved co-dwellers demand to know exactly what the heck is going on here, and if it really requires the exclusive use of six closets, the guest bedroom, and the entire garage. It's not illegal to stash yarn, you can assert with a straight face and a clear conscience. And besides, I need this.
Triptych by Stephanie Pearl McPhee. 1. I'm trying to do something about my stash because it's made its way into the kitchen again. I support, endorse, and love the idea of a stash that's whatever size your heart thinks it should be, but I also support and endorse the idea of being able to share your home with other humans, if you so choose, and that you should be able to eat at the dining room table, if that's your bag. My stash is both large and mature. I'm not a naturally tidy or organized person, so for the thing to stay usable, I need to admit that without some measure of organization, or the attempt at one at the very least, the stash will begin oozing from room to room, becoming ever more chaotic and unstable. The system I have works pretty well, though as someone who constantly fights back against the part of her that owns two dead and dusty houseplants and is still knitting instead of doing something about that, it is inevitable that the stash will have some drift. New yarn often gets stuffed in a corner. A swatched and rejected yarn doesn't make it back into its correct spot. A mitten book, or seven, that I thumbed through while contemplating my choices, ends up in the bathroom. Gradually, who I am and how infrequently I choose cleaning as an activity starts to exert itself. Entropy takes over, and the stash springs free of its moorings. I've accepted. I'm never going to live in the kind of home that you would see in a magazine, unless the magazine is running a contest that has something to do with the maximum amount of cat hair that can get stuck to a chair before a reasonable person does something about it. But I do try to keep the house just this side of a health code violation. I'll be damned, though, if I can figure out how to keep the stash restrained enough that it's not the thing people gape at when they arrive and talk about when they leave. I sometimes watch this TV show, Hoarders, Buried Alive. I don't really enjoy it, but it triggers fear-based cleaning behavior in me, and that's valuable. In one episode, the hoarder was a knitter, and while I admit that the rest of her house had a lot of problems, when the professional organizer assigned to make her home livable showed up, the first thing she went after was the stash. 4 pairs of size 6 needles? She shrieked, shocked and unbelieving. 20 balls of yarn? All blue? She was appalled, and the woman was ashamed. And I had no idea what to do with any of my feelings, because I'm pretty sure I have more yarn than the knitter on that show. As a matter of fact, I am totally confident that I have a lot more than 4 pairs of size 6 needles. And while I can agree that I shouldn't keep my blue yarn in the bathroom or next to a stack of empty pizza boxes that goes to the ceiling, I haven't ever considered it excessive. I watched in horror as this organizer tried to convince the knitter that she needed less yarn and fewer needles. I felt a little unglued. I wanted to intervene to tell them that she's being so misunderstood as an artist. I wanted to explain her choices, to say that she's going to go on to knit for a long time, and that this stash is just good planning and choices, not hoarding. I wanted to ask her if this is what she would say if her client were a painter. Would she be allowed to keep just one canvas? Would they tell her it was silly to have 14 sizes of brushes and ask her to choose the 2 she wanted to keep? Would they tell her that she simply couldn't have so many blue paints? That she'd have to decide between cerulean, navy, midnight, cobalt, and thallo? Limit her ability to express herself for the sake of tidiness? My feelings got bigger, and I got angrier. But part of me wondered, do I want to defend this stash so that mine is defensible? Instead of cleaning up the stash and shoving it back into the spaces that it should be in, do I want to pretend that my knitting can't be or shouldn't be cleaned up so that I don't have to admit that I'd rather be knitting than doing the work it would take to tidy it? Is this why I bought that poster that said, "A clean house is a sign of a wasted life"? This knitter on the show was hearing that she had too much yarn. Mostly, I think the larger issue was that she hadn't taken a bag of garbage to the bin in 17 years. If I were the organizational expert, I would have started there, let me tell you. But I get that when you're storing 22 kilos of used paper towels in your guest room, people are going to get very critical about all your stuff. I've heard from people that I have too much yarn. Often they tell me that I have more yarn than I could use in a lifetime. I don't even know if they can define that. I know that to the uninitiated, it might seem like a simple equation, how much you knit versus how much you buy, but that's not how it works. And not just because nobody knows how long I'll live or how much I will knit. They don't even know what I'm going to use it for. Most of my yarn is for knitting, but some of it has a more complicated destiny as support staff. It's there to make me want to knit. It's absolutely possible that I need the green merino to inform how I'll use the blue alpaca and that ball of gorgeous variegated yarn. You bet I've had it for 10 years, and I completely admit that it's a yarn pet. I have no intention of ever knitting it, but it's earning the real estate it takes up with how it makes me feel about knitting. It's the textile artist's equivalent of a painting hung on the wall. It's there to be beautiful and to help me dream of possibility. I sigh and look at the yarn and projects scattered around my house, and I think about how I love the way other people's homes look. I love the idea of living in a house that's well-managed and tidy. I would love it if my stash didn't keep creeping out of its confines to wind up ornamenting the kitchen but I can't figure out how that's going to happen. As long as given any choice between tidying the stash and knitting with it, the latter is going to win most of the time. I think about cleaning it up, but don't you think I would be spending all my time organizing the stash instead of working with it, and that this would make it ridiculous to own? My stash isn't just the stuff I'm going to knit. It's how I think about knitting. And frankly, some inspiration takes up more room than you'd imagine. 2. I am trying to do something about my stash. I've just finished culling it, an event that is practically a religious holiday in this house. Culling the stash is something I started doing about 10 years ago, when I had to admit that more yarn was coming into the house than was going out, and that the math on that was pretty hard to ignore. If you buy 20 skeins of sock yarn a year, and you knit only 10 pairs of socks per year, you're going to have a very compelling problem in a short period of time. I have absolutely no problem defending my yarn buying. Knitting is what I love, and it's normal, human, and smart to surround yourself with the things that make you happy and give you choices and inspiration. It's not normal to bury yourself over the course of 20 years without fighting back a little bit, even as you can see it happening. Now, during the cull, I actually get rid of yarn. Some of it goes to charity. Some of it gets rehomed to friends and family who will actually use it. But during the cull, the stash flow at my house reverses itself, and yarn, books, and needles leave the house. I don't do it just because of space, because I can't end up sleeping in the bathtub, or because I can't manage my feelings about knitting and the yarn it results in. I do it because yarn sometimes finds its way into this house without deliberate and careful thought, and without curation, without a chance to reverse the recklessness that sometimes brings yarn here, the stash starts to weigh on me. It lurks around the house, looming darkly and making me feel bad. I'm not sure what the bad feeling is, but I used to wonder if it was guilt. It would make sense. The stash is obviously in excess, and when it's at its largest, there are definitely things in it that won't get used. It's more than I need, and squeezing another skein into a shelf that's already packed feels a little like scraping half a pie into the compost while children are starving in Africa. I don't feel bad about having what I need, but I sure feel a little uncomfortable about having more than I can use and letting the potential in the yarn go to waste as it gathers dust. I thought maybe the feeling was of responsibility, some sort of culpability for having been the person who brought all this here, in whatever deranged moment of weakness unhinged me. Even if I can see now that I got that purple mohair only because it was 50% off, am I required to execute the penance of knitting it? If a tower of sock yarn is getting big enough to topple in the night and bury me so deeply that it'll be 3 days before they can excavate my lifeless form, do I have to keep trying to use it up just to avoid admitting I bought that last skein to compliment the dyer? If I made this bed, is it necessary that I have to knit it? Then there's what I do for a living. I'm a member of the knitting industry, and sometimes people give me their yarn, or they're happy to see me buy it. I like pleasing them, and I know they hope I might knit it, and they'll have a little lovely publicity. I know this, and I want to help them, but I'm one person, and I worry that somewhere they're sitting in their living room, reading my blog and thinking, "Damn it, when is she going to knit my yarn?" And I'm sitting in my stash room, looking at the same skein, only it's next to 470 others, and I feel like I'm obligated to knit all of them really, really soon. And the next thing I know, I'm feeling really sweaty. It could be one of those reasons. It might be something else. Perhaps it's possible for all that potential just to get to be too much for me. There's a mystical moment when I have more yarn than psychic energy, and it doesn't feel good anymore. It feels like a burden, and it feels like the stash isn't something I've chosen. When that happens, it's time for a cull. I have to go into the stash, look at the yarn that's come into my life, and ask myself if it still has a right to be here. If it can't be defended in my court, where the judge is kind and generous but firm, then it's time for the yarn in question to make its way into someone else's stash. I get a few boxes out, one for my knitting friends, one to donate, and I start going through the stash. The thing that amazes me while I'm at it is that every single skein I pick up and hold, every item, whether it was a gift or an impulse buy or a moment of weakness in the face of a ridiculous discount, all of this, no matter how it came to be here, at the time that it came into the stash, when I first held it in my hands, I wholly believed it was going to be the next thing I knit. As I work, I try to let go of the feelings of obligation, responsibility, and commitment, and look honestly at 12 balls of bulky mint green brushed merino that I bought in 1985, and quietly admit that my tastes have changed. I don't want that back wing sweater anymore, even if it means I wasted the money. I go through it all, sorting and deciding, and I keep going until the stash feels like what it's supposed to be, which is a pleasure. Anything that's not going to be knit by me or loved by me, or that can't explain to me exactly why it's here, that stuff moves on so that someone can enjoy it. And I can stop resenting it for being the physical embodiment of my inability to grow as a person. I admit that my stash is large. I admit that there are a lot of reasons for yarn to be in it, and I admit that I am weak in the face of yarn. I admit it all. And I cull ruthlessly so my stash reflects who I am, because otherwise, my stash makes me feel bad. 3. I am trying to do something about my stash, to bring it in line with my personal manifesto, but I'll be the first to admit that it's not going very well. I say that I let yarn go, that I release things, that I have a vision of what my stash should be. I really believe that a stash should be a source of inspiration, motivation, and the root of creativity for a textile artist. I believe in keeping things that aren't going to be knit now, or even maybe ever, as long as they are part of your personal vision. Every skein or ball should be chosen and deliberate. I don't even think a stash can be technically too big. As long as it fits within the rules, you haven't had a visit from the local authorities who want to talk about reining it in enough so that firefighters can get to you in an emergency, and the practice hasn't negatively affected your credit rating. Here I stand then, trying to take charge of this whole thing and keep it within the confines of my system. I am holding a ball of yarn that breaks every rule that I have, and according to all the criteria I have ever set, should be in the box I'm giving away. But I can't do it. I cannot let it go. It's one of a whole bunch of skeins that make no sense if you know me. Odd yarns that you wouldn't expect to find here, that I would never buy, that don't reflect who I am as an artist, that don't contribute to my work, won't be knit, aren't inspiring, and technically don't reflect the way that I like to interact with my stash. They're wild cards, with no right to be here. For example, the yarn I'm holding is variegated, with all the colors of the rainbow in it. It's dominated by a shiny filament of fake silver and a bright pink color, saccharine sweet, girly, and intense. That pink is the color of lipstick nobody buys, and not only would I never wear it, I dislike the color enough that I wouldn't even knit it for a friend who was misguided enough to think she liked it. That should be enough to get it out of here, never mind that it is a fantastically crappy acrylic. It's a yarn that you would never, ever associate with me. It's a yarn that might belong to a child who tells you that her favorite color is sparkle rainbow. One warm day in June, about 20 years ago, when my daughters were very little, they brought me a birthday present. It was wrapped in tinfoil. Very smart. You don't need tape that way. And a bit sticky. They presented it to me with pride, their little faces glowing with the delight of what they saw as a very well-executed plan. I pried open the packet, and inside was that ball of yarn, glittering brilliantly in the sunshine. They'd taken their own money, gone to the store, thought long and hard about what to get me, and settled on this particular gem. Now, true, empathy is a late-blooming flower, so they didn't quite get the details right, but I still remember the way that they showed me how pink it was, how shiny it was, and explained essentially how it was a moonbeam of beauty, the apex of elegance. I stood there, holding a ball of yarn that was exactly what you'd get if Barbie and My Little Pony dropped acid and tried to come up with a colorway, and even though it was the exact opposite of everything I like in a yarn, I loved it. It was the first time my children tried to give me a gift that reflected who I am. I can no sooner get rid of that yarn than I can set fire to their baby pictures. In another box are 24 balls of absolutely terrible yarn that my husband bought for me in China, in an afternoon that ended up a lot more complicated and expensive than he ever intended it to be. He took the time to find out where in the vast market you buy yarn, and he went there, way out of his way, navigating a country and a language he didn't know, to try to please me. It's true that when he found the yarn, he panicked and opted for quantity over quality. But how do you send a gesture of love like that to charity? Horrific pantyhose shade of taupe or not, I am emotionally stuck to that big lot of yarn. Those three over there, the ones that are neon colors, are a gift from a family friend. On her last trip here from Japan, she unloaded a great big basket of gifts from her home. Everyone got tea and rice candies and green tea flavored everything. But I got Japanese yarn. That small white ball is all that's left of the yarn I used for my eldest daughter's baby blanket. The oatmeal-colored skeins that are about as soft as twine, I bought them at a tiny yarn shop in the basement of a house in Newfoundland on one of the first trips my husband and I ever took together. The small ball of acid green polyester is all that remains of the stash of my paternal grandmother, the woman who taught me how to knit. The eight balls of tweedy red yarn with odd electric blue flecks that shreds when you try to knit it, those are the legacy of a friend who had to give up knitting and pass them into my safekeeping, sure that I could somehow fulfill their destiny. Each monstrosity is a postcard, a treasure, and makes up a scrapbook of an unusually bulky sort. I know what my stash is supposed to be, and mostly it's that. My stash is useful. It is inspiration. It is the groundwork for my art. It is the magic box of paints and tools into which I reach to make things. It's my own personal store, a curated collection of things that make my knitting life possible and let me start mittens at 1 a.m. should the magic strike me. It's the insurance policy that will let me keep knitting even if I run out of money, sheep stop bearing wool, or a zombie apocalypse closes every yarn shop in the world. But my stash is not just that. It is also memento, remembrance, and souvenir. An expression of not just what I want to make, but also who I am, who I love, where I've been, and who loves me. I'll keep as much of it as I want to, even if it's rainbow sparkle.
Without a Stash by Amy Herzog. Hello, my name is Amy. I am an avid knitter, and I have no stash. The casual observer in my home might argue with that statement. It's true, there's certainly some yarn here, but the yarn in my house is not a stash. Any knitter can tell you that having a stash isn't simply another way of saying you own some yarn. There are as many reasons to stash as there are stashers. But every stasher does have a reason. They've chosen each hank of yarn in their stash for a particular purpose, and stashes are uniquely personal as a result. Knitter stashes are both a story they tell themselves about their knitting and the means with which to live out that story. The yarn in my house is different. It fills a generous handful of little cube bins in my studio. It's a hodgepodge, remnants from past projects, sample hanks for future projects, and my next 6 to 9 months of design work. All of that yarn is lovely. Much of it is carefully chosen. But none of it is my stash. I know this because I was once as avid a stasher as I am a knitter. I picked up knitting for the second time as a young adult after several obnoxious teenage years in which I felt I was too cool for the fiber arts. My reacquaintance with knitting was uniquely tied to that time in my life. I wanted to connect to a core part of my mother's life after she passed away when I was 21. Knitting helped me sit quietly next to my new spouse as we watched a movie or TV in the evenings. It also channeled my intense desire to make things and be creative, which wasn't getting much of an outlet in my day job. I became a stasher almost immediately. My stash was a crisp and focused plan, reflected in the name of my first knitting blog, Stash, Knit, Repeat. The story my small, tidy stash told, along with its spreadsheet, was a step-by-careful-step crafting plan. I knit through the stash and replenished it regularly, obsessing over, fondling, and working through that tiny stash gave me so much joy. After a few years, my life changed, and my relationship with my stash did too. I had my first child and moved across the country to follow a professorship for my husband, which gave me the chance to stop working for a time. I packed up that tidy little stash into a single box and moved it with me. The story my stash started to tell was a calming one, the familiar hanks soothing me through the changes and uncertainty of that time. Then, when I lost 5 family members over a brutal 8 months, my stash's story changed again. It became an ongoing attempt to find beauty still left in the world, a solemn promise to be part of that beauty, even when I was feeling most bereft. This change in my stash's story started slowly. When my aunt passed unexpectedly, I found a new hand-dyed lace weight, drank in its saturated color, smelled the crisp tang of the silk, and then transformed it into a complex shawl that became more than the sum of its parts. Then when Lois, the grandmother, who was also my crafting mentor, died, I made a furious and intense commitment to knit as much as I possibly could, as quickly as I possibly could. This rich, intense hank would be lacy socks I would wear on cold winter mornings. That plump, smooth wool would transform into an adorable toddler sweater for a dear friend's little one. I'd make hanks of ultra-soft cotton into warm caps for my remaining grandmother to wear in the fall. I tried, through my stash, to capture both my own creative urge and Lois's. When both of my grandfathers followed my aunt and my grandmother, the story of my stash got more frantic as I tried to reconnect to the past I was losing. I scrambled to find the earthy goodness of a rustic wool. Smelling it transported me back to a cold, snowy afternoon, with tiny, crusty icicles melting into a comfortable smell by my grandfather's wood stove. I don't remember how old I was, but the raised stone hearth was the perfect size to sit on, basking in the warmth of the air and the stones. I was consumed by the search for the perfect colors to recreate an old stranded sweater, keeping me warm as I scrambled over granite ledges and crunched leaves while trailing after my other grandfather, walking around his land. By the time I lost a baby in my second trimester, life felt out of control. The purchase of a soft, fine wool was a dual-edged sword, reminding me of other tiny beings in my family who hadn't survived, and yet also declaring my hope that another child would be born. I buried my losses in my first trip to Rhinebeck, barely noticing anything as I shoveled hank after hank into my bag. My stash exploded during those 8 months, quickly filling bin after bin, shelf after shelf. I desperately needed the stories I told myself with that stash. I desperately needed the healing it gave me, and I don't judge myself harshly for that tumultuous time. But as the brutality faded and life settled down, I started to notice the rather large amount of yarn that now surrounded me. It became clear that in my heart of hearts, this giant stash wasn't telling the right story for me. Once it lost the deep emotional connection to the grieving process, much of the yarn I'd purchased just didn't look as enticing as it had. The story of that grief-stricken stash changed. I was left with a story of suffocating obligation and past pain and old responsibilities. The financial needs of having two preschoolers gave me the push I needed to address the mental weight of that accumulated yarn. My yarn budget became a shadow of its former self, and I started knitting through my stash. I made some purchases, of course, at a festival or from a dyer introduced to me by a friend. I knit things up quickly, and my stash kept shrinking. Eventually, there was hardly anything left. It felt so amazing. In a life otherwise filled with appointments and routines and responsibilities, my diminishing and eventually non-existent stash gave me mental permission to break out of plans and constraints and indulge in whimsy instead, to change my mind a billion times with no consequence, except the joy of being able to change my mind a billion times. Without a stash, my yarn purchasing became immediate, the hanks transforming into pieces reflecting who I was at that particular instant. I quickly worked a smooth wool silk blend into a sleek spring cardigan to match that great skirt I'd just purchased. One fall, we discovered a new hiking trail. I found a nubby, rustic woolen spun and whipped it up into a cabled pullover I could wear on the trail with my family. The next summer, I was headed to the ocean for a weekend, but nights are cold up in Maine, so I dashed to the store for my favorite hemp blend and pulled together a beachy sweatshirt. When I was in a place where my knitting urges focused on others, my stashless projects told that story too. My eldest came home from kindergarten one day begging for knee socks. We hit the local fiber festival to find sock yarn that screamed, "Jacob," and he proudly slipped them on the second they were off my needles. I have a fantastic picture of his giant silly grin as he posed on one leg for the camera. My always chilly husband shaves his head, and a quick drop in temperatures one cold November Saturday sent me running for a hank of his favorite cashmere blend. I'd finished a little indoor cap by the end of the night, much to his delight. And on and on and on. In my years without a stash, I've discovered something beautiful. When I got rid of the yarn that bound me to previous versions of myself, my projects were finally able to tell the story I spent years trying and failing to articulate with my stash. It turns out that the most important parts of my fiber life were never about the stash. The bits of my family, myself, and my friends that I tried to work into yarn purchases got tangled up in history and baggage and stale expectations instead. Their stories fell flat. These bits of me and my loved ones couldn't be blended into hanks of yarn on a shelf. They needed to be blended into my creations instead. The story those creations tell is so much more satisfying than anything my stash ever said to me. Now everything I create is rooted entirely in where I am at that particular time. Some items reflect on what has come before, some zing crazily to the side, some are lavish, and some sturdily simple. The things I've made since I stopped stashing make an authentic, beautiful story of the woman I've been, the people I've loved, and the life I've led. I know what a stash can do for a person. I deeply, respectfully understand it, but I'm vastly happier without one. The careful reader will probably remember that I admitted to having a decently large chunk of yarn in my house. And it's fair to ask, if that yarn isn't a stash, what on earth is it? The truth is, it's just yarn. My knitting story got a bit more complicated about 5 years ago, when I started designing professionally. The yarn in my house got a bit more complicated, too. At first, the switch to designing resulted in a huge influx of yarn. My first book had 21 adult-sized sweaters in it, and let me tell you, the week all that yarn showed up was a pretty daunting one. My work for magazines, more yarn. My own pattern line, more yarn. Things really got out of hand when I realized that I had even more control over the yarn design marriage than I'd originally thought. Wait a minute. I can speak directly with a yarn company about what a particular idea wants, and then the exact yarn I need for this exact idea shows up at my house, made just for me? The perfect result of a creative collaboration? Yes, please. The yarn was back. Briefly. That heady influx of yarn slowed down and got used up pretty quickly. Yarns tend to turn over rapidly, with something getting discontinued pretty much every season. And nobody wants a new pattern to call for a yarn that's already been discontinued. I was soon back to acquiring yarn and knitting it up almost immediately. I do tend to keep more yarn around the house than I did before I started designing, because at this point in my career, I plan my design schedule out about a year. In the interest of helping you understand why I still consider myself a stashless knitter, here's a brief tour of what's in those bins. The smallest amount of yarn is detritus from past projects. I try to acquire generous enough yardage that I have a lot of design flexibility. That almost always results in a hank or three left over at the end of a project. These leftovers collect until they outgrow their bin, at which point I donate, slash review, slash hold a contest, slash give the yarn to someone who can do something lovely with it. Next, in terms of actual quantity, is swatching yarn. Sample hanks, both full-size and mini, for swatching and planning out the next set of projects and collaborations. Finally, there are the sweater quantities. They represent a smallish number of projects, a giant amount of yardage, and somewhere between 6 and 12 months of work. This yarn, between 8 and 20 sweaters worth, comes from businesses I believe in and represents the best our industry has to offer. Much of it is chosen strategically to make a coherent and easily acquired portfolio of garments. A very few sweaters worth is yarn that caused me to squeal with delight and grab it with greedy hands the second I saw it. I try to keep creative juices flowing by giving myself an immediate just because project every season. All told, the yarn in my house probably totals 1 to 2 giant plastic bins. It will all be gone within a year. Much of it says very little that's uniquely personal to me. It's stunningly beautiful. But if it all disappeared tomorrow, I'd just shrug and make a new work plan. It's lovely yarn, and I enjoy working with it. But at the end of the day, it's an especially inspiring set of work materials. It's not a stash, and I wouldn't have it any other way. In the nearly 20 years since I picked my knitting needles back up again, in this one little tiny part of my life, I've lost myself in the pure joy of ephemera. I get great pleasure out of the freedom to make my crafty tomorrow whatever I'd like it to be when I get there. Maybe I'll want to dive into a series of lace wraps. Or more knee socks for the boys, who are rapidly becoming young men. Or a lap blanket. Or a cozy hat. Or a sweater like the ones my mother made us when we were kids. Or something inspired by that top I finally worn to death. Or maybe not. Maybe I'll want to do something I can't even conceive of now. I'll figure it out when I get there. I don't need to plan for it. I don't want to plan for it. I don't want to shackle tomorrow's creativity to the place I'm in today. There will be yarn that's perfect for whatever is captivating me at the moment. Or not, and I'll move on to something else. It's all good. My name is Amy. I'm an avid knitter with no stash. And no desire to acquire one. Who would have thought?
The Life-Changing Magic of Keeping It All by Anne Shane. I'm tidying. I'm doing the things with the stuff that Marie Kondo is telling me to do. Listening to the audiobook of The Life-Changing Magic of Tidying Up is frankly like enduring a sweet-voiced nag session from the cubicle mate you never really liked. I know, I know, I know, I know. Marie Kondo is, however,